This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk, sitting in for Mike Collins. The U.S. Senate is considering the most ambitious immigration overhaul in decades. It's the result of months of negotiations between a bipartisan group of senators known as the Gang of Eight, four Republicans, four Democrats. The bill they came up with aims to fundamentally change the way immigration works in the United States. It creates a pathway to citizenship for millions in the country illegally, it establishes tough and technological border security measures, and it shifts the system's focus from families to workers and students. Those are just a couple highlights from the 844-page bill. This hour, we're going to read every single page. I'm kidding, that would be awful. What we're actually going to do is give you an approachable and at times personal explanation of what's in the bill and how it would impact Charlotte and North Carolina as a whole. Here to help us do that is Peter Ciavellis, political science professor at Wake Forest University and co-editor of Getting Immigration Right, What Every American Needs to Know. Welcome, Peter.
Nice to be here, Michael. Thank you.
And Armando Belmas, director of communications for the Latin American Coalition in Charlotte. Welcome to you, too.
Thanks, Michael.
And later in the show, we'll also be joined by a young immigrant to hear his story. So, Armando, could you start us off by describing the immigrant community in Charlotte?
Well, the immigrant community in Charlotte is very diverse. The majority of the people that we interact with at the Latin American Coalition on a daily basis are newcomers to Charlotte, new immigrants who have just gotten here, who have been here for a few years, and are looking for something to kind of help them get on their feet, be it English classes, an email address, a place to check their emails, a Facebook account to stay in touch with their family, a referral to another agency here in Charlotte. So we see a big portion of that community at the Latin American Coalition. But then through our festivals and some of our other events, we also see different folks, middle-class folks like myself. We see affluent folks who come out to celebrate. So the community is diverse, and the great part about it is that it's growing on a daily basis. More people are coming to Charlotte, not just to work, but also to raise families, just like everybody else does, because it's a great place for it.
And I've read, based on census data, that North Carolina has one of the fastest growing immigrant populations, the state as a whole. We're now at the point where more than 1 in 10 North Carolinians are Latino or Asian. And we also have a rather large Asian population here as well, correct?
We do, yes. We have one of our partner organizations at the Latin American Coalition is the Southeast Asian Coalition. And they're doing a similar thing of trying to get folks who are here from Southeast Asia more integrated into the community, give them a stronger voice in the community because their numbers are growing as well.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty of this bill, let's put it in historical context. So, Peter, when's the last time the United States was considering this big of a change to its immigration system?
Without a doubt, this is the biggest comprehensive immigration reform since 1986 under the Reagan administration, the IRCA Act, the Immigration Reform Control Act. And that was the last time that there was any sort of immigration reform that was this big in scope, and also the last time there was a path to citizenship considered. About 2.7 million immigrants were, their status here was normalized under that act. And I think what's important to keep in mind that people, when they're talking about the path to citizenship right now, are acting as if this is some sort of historical, that this is some sort of historical departure from what we've done in the past. But there's been dozens, literally dozens of junctures in history where this sort of so-called amnesty has been given to immigrants, starting as late as the 1920s through the 1940s, a major naturalization or normalization act in 1952 under the McCarran-Walter Act. So this is going to be important legislation, but it's also important to bear in mind that there is a good deal of precedent for this type of legislation. In essence, we've been here before. Like, there's nothing new under the sun when it comes to this act.
And since the last, I guess, major one in 86, have there been more recent but smaller attempts that have failed?
Absolutely. Several times, you know, principally in the lead up to the 2008 election, there was an attempt at comprehensive immigration reform. I think what's important to note is that throughout this entire process, that these reform efforts make for really strange bedfellows because you have sort of opposition from the far right and opposition from the far left for different reasons. And really the place to build some kind of coalition for reform is in the middle. On the far right, you have people opposing for sort of cultural reasons, linguistic reasons, people on the far left to sort of protect workers' rights. And what we see is in the middle, the business community, moderate Democrats, that they do tend to be able to come together to build a coalition for reform. It was derailed last time for a whole variety of reasons, but we've been here before.
Okay. So let's dive into the current bipartisan bill. Perhaps the biggest headline is that it creates a pathway to citizenship for the roughly 11 million people living in the country illegally. They would need to meet certain requirements and pay fines and taxes. Armando, would you help explain what those requirements are in this most recent pathway?
Well, the first one is that there's a cutoff date of December 31st, 2011, I believe.
So you had to have been here before then?
Yes, before that date. So anybody that was here after that is not eligible, would not be eligible for this pathway to citizenship. And so that's the big one. And then after that, there's a lot of milestones that need to be met. For instance, a person needs to start the process of biometrics, background checks, and that kind of stuff.
It's about a 10 to 13 year process. Is
yeah,
that right?
And so there's like a 6 year renewal period, and then there's another period that you have to initiate your actual LPR status, legal permanent resident status. So all in all, it's about 10 to 13 year period that folks have to go through on top of the time that they've already been here.
I mean, I think it's important to note also in terms of being able to sell this immigration reform, because a lot of voices on the right, especially, object to the fact that indeed people who came here did break the law. So also contained in that path to citizenship, it's important to note that there's a penalty. The proposal is currently $1,000. There's a work requirement. There's a requirement to learn English. There's a requirement to pay any back taxes. So in that sense, also this act tends to throw a bone to people who are very, very concerned about the legal consequences of having violated U.S. law, which I think is important in terms of guaranteeing its passage.
And on that note, so you do have this pathway that's long and that will cost, you know, a certain amount of money. It could be a significant amount of money based on your background. I mean, Armando, what do you guys think of, the initial look at this pathway?
Well, for a lot of the people that we work with on a daily basis, it's great because they do qualify. But then there are some people who have been here after that and have still, I mean, they've established a life here. They have children here. They have a family here. And they need to be able to be part of that pathway as well. Because there's that cutoff date, it seems sort of arbitrary, considering the fact that the legislation isn't coming until about a year and a half, 2 years later. So that's something that we definitely want there to be some kind of consideration for those families who might still be separated or be forced to leave or might still kind of stay in that limbo.
I think the other thing that's important to note, Armando, is that if we create a path to citizenship that's not tenable for people to follow, it doesn't make any sense to do so. It's worthless. We're not going to bring the 11 million people that need to come out of the shadows out of the shadows. So in this sense, we have to walk a fine line between trying to make that path to citizenship a path that people have to follow and have to fulfill certain requirements, but also a path that people can effectively follow. And if we make that path too difficult, if we throw up too many obstacles, we're going to end up with the same problem after this reform that we had before.
And you know, based on the length and the cost, I mean, do you still think this is something that a lot of people in our community, you know, would be able to walk through, to walk out?
I do think so. Yeah. I mean, it's the discouraging part is the length. You know, when you look at 10 to 13 years down the road before you can actually finally get this citizenship, that's a long time, especially if you've already been here for a while. But for the majority of people, like I mentioned before, it's definitely something that they can kind of get into because it's going to give them that access at some point, but it's just going to take a long time.
And Peter, I know that you've said that we've been here before, but a pathway that has, you know, this length, these types of fines, has there been a pathway like this that's been proposed before?
Well, almost universally, for all the historical precedents that I talked about before, there's always a requirement of good character. You know, that sounds like sort of 19th century language, but almost always there's some sort of, you know, have you committed a crime, whatever, or some sort of language that says you have good character. There's almost always some sort of fine. There's almost sort of some process where you have to go through and admit your guilt. That is to say, yes, I did break the law. So in that sense, I don't know the exact fine under the IRCA Act. I was trying to do some research on that and couldn't find the exact cost of that. But it was very successful in normalizing the status of 2.7 million individuals, which was about the size of the undocumented population at the time. So in that sense, it was an effective path to citizenship. And I think we should look at it carefully to make sure that this new, whatever legislation is passed, that this new path to citizenship has some parallels to past ones.
And I wonder if the way that this is structured as far as the length and those fines, I know that we've been here before, but if these are things that you think are specifically put in place, so that it seems like, I think Senator Marco Rubio, Republican of Florida, has called it an arduous path to try to help sell it to the right, I suppose?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for the law and order crowd, that really is, you hear this chorus again and again, well, they broke the law, they broke the law, they broke the law. Well, indeed they have. But, many people in this country have broken the law and are not labeled the rest of their lives as say, someone who, if you run a stop sign, you're not labeled for the rest of your life as a stop sign runner, right?
Right.
So in this sense, for the law and order folks, I think it's important this admission of guilt and some sort of penalty to be able to sell the legislation, whether you're in favor or whether you think it's warranted or not. If it's going to be effectively sold, it has to include some sort of path, but let's avoid making it too arduous a path, because then it's useless, as I said.
Well, and as far as that part that needs something that you need to put in there to sell it, there's a contingency also in there that none of this can start until the Department of Homeland Security secures the border even further. There's some touch points that they kind of have to meet, some benchmarks that they have to meet over the course of the next 6 months to a year, where if these things aren't in place, this other part can't start yet.
Right. And I'd like to get a little bit more to that into that in a minute. But I guess, first of all, on this pathway, I mean, what do you think it would mean? Let's say this goes through. I mean, how much of a difference would that make for Charlotte and for North Carolina, for people who are living here now?
Well, there's a few families that I can think of right off the top of my head who are they're hardworking. They've been living here in Charlotte for 8 to 10, 15 years. And this is their life. They came here because it's a great place to live, because it's a great place to raise a family, because there's work. And the only problem is that they don't have status. They are undocumented. So this pathway to citizenship for them would be a way for them to become citizens, to become permanent residents, to become part of this community in that legal way. And for them, that's great. It kind of takes that fear out of their minds, because a lot of these folks, they're driving to work every day, they're taking their kids to school every day, just like we do, and they're in fear of being stopped by the police and not having a driver's license, and then being taken to jail, and then put into deportation proceedings, and then being faced with the possibility of being separated from their wife and kids, for instance. So they don't have. It kind of gets rid of that fear that they
right.
have hanging.
You're
over
getting
them.
To a key point, which is once you start on this pathway, you no longer have to fear being deported. Right.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Which is it's kind of like deferred action for childhood arrivals. So
which is what President Obama's administration started about a year ago, which says if you're a certain age, you're working towards either going to school or work, you can stay in the country for 2 years.
Yeah. If you were brought here as a child, and so it's kind of a deferred action until you reach that status.
I think this brings up an interesting point, that too much of the dialogue right now has been simply about rights, like the rights of immigrants. Also, what we have to realize is that through this path to citizenship, it also involves responsibilities, right? And so paying taxes, getting a driver's license, paying the Social Security system, citizenship comes with not just rights, but also responsibilities, and that's important.
And we're going to need to take a quick break, and we'll pick up right where we left off there. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk, sitting in for Mike Collins. Today we're doing a deep dive into the proposed overhaul of the country's immigration system. Here to help us understand the bill that's been filed by a bipartisan group of U.S. senators is Peter Ciavellis, political science professor at Wake Forest University, and Armando Belmas, spokesman for the Latin American Coalition. Before the break, Peter, you were talking about the idea of responsibilities that immigrants who are in the country illegally right now already have and some of the things they've been doing.
I do want to stress the point that Armando brought up during the break, that indeed immigrants are paying taxes. They're paying taxes into the system in all sorts of different ways, including sales taxes and all the rest. I guess what I was referring to mostly was, getting that status regularized and also beginning to pay into the Social Security system. They're paying into the Social Security system now, but not into their own accounts, often into others, or sometimes not paying the Social Security system. I think this brings up an irony. We're having a big debate about entitlements and how to continue entitlements. I think one of the biggest solutions to our Social Security crisis is to normalize a group of workers that's in their prime of their working years, that would enhance the pool of people paying into the system. And in this sense, we could simultaneously solve our immigration and Social Security problem all at once.
Yeah, and one of the one of the numbers that we always keep batting around that to us is we were astonished when we heard it was just a couple of years ago, undocumented immigrants just in North Carolina paid $317.7 million in state and local taxes. I mean, that number is staggering. I mean, that's in an era where we're always looking for money, looking for ways to cut money and all that. That's a big chunk of money that's going into the state from people who technically aren't supposed to be here.
And we've been talking about the pathway to citizenship. And excuse me, Armando, as you brought up, it's not necessarily an automatic thing. If the bill becomes law, it's tied to certain border security measures. excuse me, that must be achieved over time. Those include better surveillance using technology like drones, more border agents and fencing, and the implementation of an E-Verify system for businesses to use. Republican Senator Marco Rubio of Florida says the bill has the toughest border security measures in United States history. Peter, how's that claim stack up?
I mean, I really think the whole border security claim is something of a red herring. It's something of a way to kind of distract our attention from really what's at the core of the need for immigration reform. I could just ask a simple question. At what point will we know that we have a secure border? Tell me what the indications are. How could we measure that? What we need to talk about here is the incentives driving the push for immigration, the incentive driving the pull for immigration. A wall, you can build it higher, you can build it wider, you can put more barbed wire on top of it. But if the incentives don't change, people are going to get around those incentives. And indeed, I think we're seeing that right now. There's zero net immigration from Mexico right now because the economic situation of the United States has deteriorated and the economic situation in Mexico has improved. In fact, there's some anecdotal evidence that there's actually remittances going back to Mexico from the United States, which is a first.
And there was a report that came out earlier this year that that showed that the current administration, presidential administration, has spent more on immigration and customs enforcement than they have for the FBI, the DEA, CIA, and all those other agencies, federal enforcement agencies combined. I mean, it's over $18 billion. So the border is more secure already. But like you said, Peter, there needs to be that kind of incentive in there for the border security folks who want to hear that tied or as part of a more comprehensive package.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not an open border person. I don't think we just throw down everything and we let people, you know, willy-nilly cross borders whenever they want. If you're a libertarian on the Republican side, you might believe that. But I do think nations have a right to regulate who enters and who leaves. What I'm saying is that given the goals we want to achieve, I don't think border security is going to get us to those goals.
Well, and on that topic of who's entering and who's leaving, we should probably address concerns that some in Congress have raised about slowing down the push for immigration reform while law enforcement finds out more about the Boston Marathon bombings. The bombings were allegedly carried out by immigrant brothers who were granted political asylum about a decade ago. Here's how one of the senators behind the bill has addressed that issue. This is Democrat Chuck Schumer of New York speaking on CNN's State of the Union.
There are some on the hard right, who oppose our immigration bill from the get-go, and they're using this as an excuse. We are not going to let them do that. If they have a reason, a suggestion as to how to change it based on what happened in Boston, we'll certainly be open to it. But we're not going to let them use what happened in Boston as an excuse because our law toughens things up.
And actually, later last week, two top Republicans, Congressman Paul Ryan and House Speaker John Boehner, have said that they do not think the bombings in themselves should slow down the push for immigration reform. Peter, how much of an impact do you think that the bombings will have on this debate?
I hope none, because it really is quite a distraction. And I think that Boehner and Ryan know that. I think those on the hard right really are trying to derail the process by bringing this sort of issue up. let's really think about what we're talking about here. They're saying, let's investigate the background and what happened, the immigration status. What concrete action would we actually take were we to find that there was some kind of violation of immigration law on the behalf of these individuals? To have prevented what had happened, this would have meant to completely close immigration off from certain areas of the world. This would exclude hundreds of thousands of engineers that make contributions to American society, people working in other areas as well. So are we really willing to shut off immigration completely for the odd chance that some individual might commit a crime at some point in the future? I'm not dismissing the magnitude of this crime.
Right.
It was egregious, serious, and awful crime. But we have to keep things in perspective as well and say, what are our ultimate goals in the immigration reform process? We don't live in a police state. This is part of the cost of an open society. Also, what I want to make clear is that this is also a distraction because we're talking about different groups of individuals. Every single documented case of a terrorist attack or attempted terrorist attack has come from people who have entered the United States using legal processes, often through airports, not across the southern border. And most of the people that we're talking about with respect to comprehensive immigration reform are folks that have crossed the southern border, the vast majority of which are hardworking families that want jobs and decent lives for their families.
One of the senators who's also spoken about this and in other parts of the bill is Republican Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. We actually asked him to join us, but he declined our repeated requests. Graham is one of the senators who put together the immigration overhaul. He's one of the Gang of Eight. And here's what he has said about this overhaul on CNN's State of the Union.
2013, I hope, will be the year that we pass bipartisan immigration reform with three goals. To do the bill in such a fashion to prevent a third wave of illegal immigration from happening in this country, to make sure that the guest worker program is available to employers who can't find an American worker once you offer the job at a competitive wage, and turn our chain migration, family-based immigration system into a merit-based immigration system with a family component.
That last part, shifting from a family-based immigration system to a merit-based immigration system, Peter, how big of a change is that?
I think that's pretty huge. I think it's a departure from previous immigration reform efforts. And again, speaking politically, I think this is also a way to sell this immigration reform. What this does effectively is privilege market forces over the forces of family and personal relationships. And I think this is a way to make this immigration reform more attractive to the business community.
Well, and how does it do that? Could you explain the merit-based system a little
bit? Sure. The merit-based system, what it does is there's a series of visas known as H-1B visas, which allow a certain number of science professionals, engineers, and doctors to enter the United States. They're going to increase this quota under the comprehensive immigration reform proposal of the Gang of Eight. Also, there's going to be a series of elements that are going to be introduced that allow visas for foreign entrepreneurs, a merit-based visa system for those who earn points in a schema based on education, employment, length of residence in the United States. And also, there's going to be a new visa for low-skilled workers that is going to expand the pool of lower-skilled workers.
And from my understanding, about 75% of visas in the United States are family-based, roughly, as of now. And the idea of this bill is that would gradually, you know, this is over an expanse of time, get down closer to 50-50 between families and kind of work-based visas. Armando, what do you think of that shift?
Well, It's troubling because one of the big things that we deal with at the Latin American Coalition is the separation of families, with families being separated through deportations or only one family member being able to come to the U.S. and leaving a family behind, or vice versa, having to leave because of deportation and then leaving his family here. The inability for that family to be reunited to us is very troubling. And decreasing those chances is also pretty troubling.
But at the same time, there are things in this bill, correct, that could help towards reuniting?
Yeah, and so it isn't expressed directly in the bill, but what we're looking at is something that will allow people who have been deported and have U.S. citizen family here still in the States, for them to be able to petition to come back and be reunited with their family.
And that's as long as they didn't break any laws besides entering the country.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to get at the particulars of this, because what this shift does is essentially, before there was a wider range of familial relations that you could base application for immigration on, now no longer can you apply as an adult sibling or a parent. It has to be just children and spouses of those who are being considered for full legal status. There is one little family-friendly aspect incorporated into this bill, which I think is actually very positive. In a very big change, the new series of W visas for lower-skilled workers will allow low-skilled immigrant workers to bring their immediate family with them, which is a departure from the past, and I think a positive development.
The bill also, as you mentioned, the side of it that goes that awards more visas to highly skilled workers. Mm-hmm. The North Carolina Chamber of Commerce, other chambers of commerce have kind of stood behind that as saying this is a good idea. As you mentioned, we've got the guest worker program for low skilled workers. Then there's the new visa program that's specifically for farm workers, which is, of course, a big deal in North Carolina, which has one of the largest populations of migrant farm workers in the country. Armando, what do you think of those visas, the low skilled and the farm worker visas?
Well, those are great. We recently had a meeting with Representative Robert Pittenger, where we met with him to talk a little bit about immigration reform and whether or not he would be behind it and what we would need to do to kind of get to that point. And we brought with us a gentleman from here in North Carolina who runs a construction company. And he can't find any, he's part of the E-Verify program. He's got to be part of that, where he has to make sure that the people who come work for him are verified to work in the U.S.
And this is also part of the bill, correct?
Right. E-Verify was instituted in North Carolina about a year and a half ago.
Okay.
In 2011. And so what he's having a hard time doing is finding people who could work. And he's got great pay, great working conditions. He's got a ton of work, but he just doesn't have enough people who can work for him. And he can go out and find some folks and pick up some folks, from a lot somewhere who are just standing around waiting to work, but he can't do that because of the restrictions that he has as a business owner. And so something like this low-skilled worker visa would definitely help him get the necessary workers and employees that he needs.
And would this allow farm workers who are in the country illegally to continue working on the farms that they're in if they take this pathway?
Right. There's two elements to that I think are important to point out. First, on the pathway to citizenship, both agricultural workers that are currently here and those under the DREAM Act eligible, the group that's under eligibility for the DREAM Act would get privileged benefits, expedited eligibility for a path to citizenship.
Right, and we'll get a little bit more into the young people who kind of have an express lane in a little bit later in the show.
Right, but that would also include agricultural workers that are here. I think the other thing that's important is a lot of folks on the left in labor are opposed to some of these types of agricultural visas for a whole variety of reasons. And what I think is important, I count myself among some of those people that opposed it before, but I think what's important about this new bill is that there is a concession to labor and to immigrant rights advocates, because there are now whistleblower protections under the visa. There's a complaints process. There's a guarantee of equivalent wages. And most importantly, there's a ability to change jobs, which didn't exist in the past, which provided essentially what amounted to an indentured service for many workers. They can now change jobs under the bill.
And of course, one of the ways that this bill creates more visas on the work side of things is by cutting two particular types of family-based visas. Those are, Peter, you had mentioned this, it's ones that allow U.S. citizens to petition for their siblings and their children over the age of 30 who are married to join them.
And their parents as well.
Yeah, and I'm curious, how much of an impact would that actually have? Those seem like very specific kinds of categories.
You know, I don't know exactly how much it would have in the Latino community, because we haven't really looked into that at the coalition, but I do know through our partnership with the Southeast Asian Coalition, that is one of their biggest issues with this this Senate immigration bill from the Gang of Eight, is that it will cut off that ability for people from within the Southeast Asian community to petition for their family members. And they're really pushing to get some of that taken out.
And another thing that's, I guess, a family point on this is that it seeks to address the current million person backlog of people who have applied for family-based visa petitions and are still waiting, right? I mean, does this bill address that massive backlog?
You know, I haven't seen where it does. Have you, Peter?
No, I've seen some indication that there's going to be some effort to, you know, Obama talked about this in his proposal, and other advocates of the Gang of Eight proposal. I don't know the particulars, but have talked about the importance of those already in line not having to go to the back of the line and being able to move forward. So I'm not sure of the exact provisions, because this bill is absolutely huge, as you mentioned.
Right.
but I think there is some elements to assure fairness for those that are already so-called waiting in line for normalized status.
Well, and you know, for one of the things that we like to say at the coalition is that, you know, for a lot of these people, there is no line. We have an immigration law clinic where we see people who've been waiting for 15, 20 years to kind of get their cases moving, and they're still kind of stalled. There's a site somewhere where you can check what the current status is depending on what country you're coming from. But I mean, there's backlogs going back, you know, to 1993.
And there's evidence actually of the many, many cases where the sponsoring individual has died. Right.
And wow. Before the petition was.
Exactly. Wow. Exactly. And so in that sense, you know, the opportunity for that immigrant who's waiting in whatever country it may be. And some, as Armando said, some have very, very long lines that literally your application ceases to exist when that sponsoring individual dies.
So clearly this will be something to watch then, how this bill will end up. And, you know, if it reaches a final form, how it will address this massive backlog.
Absolutely.
Real quickly here. Peter, I guess just this idea of this shift from family-based to work-based, bottom line, is this one of the things that as a bipartisan group of legislators has found, this is just kind of a perfect or as good a compromise as you can get to try to make sure that this is going to go through?
I think it is. I think the what we've talked about, the bones thrown to people interested in law and order, the merit-based visa system, all I think is very much part of this movement, as I've said, from a more market-friendly kind of immigration reform that can be much more attractive to the business community.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, a young immigrant will join us to tell his story. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk in for Mike Collins. We've been examining a proposed bipartisan overhaul of the country's immigration system and what it means for Charlotte and North Carolina. With us is Peter Ciavellis, political science professor at Wake Forest University, and Armando Belmas, spokesman for the Latin American Coalition. And joining us now is Elver Barrios, a 22-year-old immigrant who has lived in Charlotte after his family came here from Guatemala. Elver is also a community organizer for the Latin American Coalition. Elver, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
So I guess first off, would you mind telling us your story about how your family first got to America?
Yeah, it all started back in 97 when my dad decided to immigrate here so that my brothers and I, and along with my mom, could have a better future in Guatemala. And he came here and he saw these great opportunities, you know, that, you know, potentially could be for me and my brothers. So my mom came here to help my dad in 2000. And then they stayed here working hard so that, you know, we could have a better future. But, you know, as violence got worse in Guatemala, they made the choice, and I think it was the best choice they ever made to bring me and my brothers to the United States in 2005.
Okay, and have you been in Charlotte since 2005?
Yes, I've lived here since 2005.
Okay, so what have been, I guess, your biggest challenges growing up here with your situation?
Well, I came here when I was about to turn 14, so I didn't speak any English. And when I first was enrolled in school, it was really hard to see, you know, it was really different, you know, to start off, like, you know, new language, new people, and I didn't know really where I was. And, you know, getting used to a new kind of foods and music and environment, and it was hard. But I learned English, and, you know, I moved on to high school. I went to middle school for a few months, and then I moved on to high school where, you know, my freshman year, I didn't know any English either.
Wow.
And I was struggling to learn it because I really wanted to be part of this community because I wanted to explore more and learn more about the people who are from here. And it took me a while. Over 2 years, I learned English pretty well, and I moved out of ESL onto regular classes. And I was in school, and I remember this one time when I went to ask somebody about college because, you know, my dream house had always been to be in the medical field back then. So I asked somebody, and they were like, okay, well, you need to take several steps. And one of them is start applying for scholarships And, you know, the time when you are a junior, you have to start applying for colleges and FAFSA and all that good stuff. And when she asked me for my social, I said, well, I don't think I have one.
A social security number.
A social security number. And that's, you know, the point I hit when it came to me, you know, it's real now. Like, you know, I'm here without documents and, you know, I don't really know what this means. You know, what am I able to do? And then driver's ed came and I tried to sign up for it too, but I couldn't. You know, I could take the classes, but then the instructor told me that, you know, I couldn't go to DMV and get a driver's license because I don't have a social security number. So, you know, that separated me from me and my other friends. You know, seeing that barrier that, you know, a kid shouldn't see.
And have you been able to get into any colleges?
Yes, actually, I graduated from high school in 2009. I was in the top 11% of my class. And I couldn't go to college because of that, because I didn't have a social security number. And after 3 years, I finally worked really hard, took the SAT many times, and I'm now enrolled in Johnson City University.
And let me ask as well, is part of the way, did you getting enrolled have anything to do with applying for deferred action status, which is, of course, when young people can apply to stay in the country without fear of deportation?
Yeah, no, I started at Johnson City Smith like 6 months before that. I started in January 2012, and the president announced it in June 2012. So that had nothing to do with it. Even though deferred action passed, it doesn't mean I can go to school. It only means that I can work, pay taxes, and live here, you know, without fear of being deported. But that doesn't mean I can go to school.
And it's for a limited amount of time, too.
It's only 2 years, and you can renew it every 2 years only.
So are you concerned that, you know, at some point while you're in school, you may not be able to finish?
My concern, it's you know, I'm going to finish no matter what. You know, like, I'm going to, you know, do anything I have to do to finish my education. My concern is, like, in 3 years when I graduate, you know, will deferred action be out there? You know, will be there something else for me? Because I will be able to work, you know, but what if they take that out? What if, you know, things changes so drastically and I will be able to work, then, you know, what's my education worth?
And I'm curious, and Armando, you may be able to speak to this. Elver or Armando, I mean, do you guys know if there are a lot of other people who are your age in this community who have had struggles getting into college or have looked at deferred action but see that as, you know, a closing window?
Yeah, I have. You know, I work a lot with high school students that, you know, are about to graduate and they're trying to struggle, you know, like, I can't apply for financial aid. If I fill out the FAFSA, you know, it's not going to help me. I cannot get loans from the banks because they won't give it to me. I can apply for certain scholarships because they require resident status or citizenship status. And those that aren't requiring that are very competitive because everybody can apply. So it's really hard to pursue an education, you know, if you're undocumented. You know, and even, you know, they have the fair action, they have to work, but in the state of North Carolina, they have to pay out-of-state tuition. You know, if you have graduated from North Carolina and you're undocumented, you have to pay out-of-state tuition, and that's a lot of money, you know. So, you know, even having the deferred action, it's helpful, but not enough.
And there are some people who just don't qualify for deferred action for whatever reason. They just don't meet one of the requirements, but they're still great students. They still want to go to college. They graduated from high school, but they're kind of in limbo because they don't qualify for deferred action, and they can't meet the needs of a university financially or whatever it may be.
And so are you having to pay out of state tuition then? Where you
no,
are now?
Because Johnson City Smith is a private school, so I just have to pay whatever, you know, their tuition is.
Okay. So we've discussed this pathway to citizenship earlier in the show, and we've mentioned briefly that there is somewhat of an express lane for young people like you, Elver, in which it would only take about 5 years to become citizens as long as you go to college or join the military. So, I mean, as somebody who's in college right now, I mean, what do you think of that pathway?
I think it's a great pathway just because, you know, there are around 65,000 students that graduate every year from high school who are undocumented. And imagine, you know, in next month, 65,000 students are going to be graduating from high school. And, you know, if immigration reform passes this year, that means that in four years, you know, they're going to be one step close to become citizens. And when they're done with college or university, you know, they're going to wait just one more year to feel, you know, fully part of this community, this society, you know, that, you know, they have grown up with. And I think it's great to have this express pathway, as people call it, just because, you know, most of us have grown here. I've lived here part of my life. Here's where, you know, I learned to live, basically, you know. And, you know, I know kids that came here when they were 2 years old, you know, just a few months old. And all they know is here, you know. And I think it's a great way to show them, you know, to show them that they can be part of this place.
I think Elver's really making the point very, very clearly about what's going on here. I mean, fundamentally, the United States historically has done immigration well. And the way we've done immigration well historically is by giving people opportunities. And if we don't change things right now, people, young people, are not going to have opportunities. Young people are not going to be able to follow the path that previous immigrants have been able to follow through having opportunities. And also, just even if we think about it from the self-interest of society, do we want a bunch of young people around with nothing to do and no opportunities and no future? I think that's contrary to the values of the United States.
Well, to play the devil's advocate here, though, I mean, what would you say to people who would argue that, you know, some of these young people are here because their parents broke laws and there should be repercussions for that?
I mean, all the more reason. I mean, the students themselves did nothing. The parents broke the law. And yeah. The students themselves, the young people, like Elver, are the ones that are suffering.
Yeah, but like, you know, like I said earlier, you know, I came here because my parents brought me here, you know, but that was a choice they made for me. And I respect that, you know, I am grateful for that decision that they made for me and my brothers, because if I was in Guatemala right now, maybe I wouldn't be alive, because the violence is so bad that, you know, they're, you know, killings every day of young people that because, you know, you won't go join a gang or maybe you're talking to somebody, you know, the wrong person, and you might be killed. So, you know, I completely don't blame my parents for bringing me here. You know, they made the right choice for me, and I am grateful for that. You know, I am in a great country, and I want to take advantage of these opportunities and have a family here, you know, have a life, because here's where I have grown.
And Armando, I mean, how many other young people that you work with do you hear they would also like to take advantage of this opportunity?
A whole bunch. You know, Elver is the leader of a group we have at the Latin American Coalition called United for the Dream, that came together in 2010 around the Advocating for the Dream Act that unfortunately didn't pass at the end of the year. However, they decided to keep working, keep finding ways to kind of bring more kids on, bring more young people on to advocate for the rights of young people who were brought here when they were young. And the group has grown. There's a lot of members in it now. It started a program called College Access para Todos, which kind of was the result of the Dream Act not passing. It was a way to find resources for undocumented young people to go to school, to take the SAT, to find ways to continue their education after high school. And it's the program's still going, and it's doing great.
Yeah, and, you know, that as a young person, you know, I'd like to say to people that I am the future of this country. We all are, you know, doesn't matter what color you are, doesn't matter your nationality. You know, we are the future of this country. But, you know, let's remember that we're also the present. You know, and we are here. You know, we are real people. You know, and this is our lives. It's our future as well. And, you know, taking a moment to think about, you know, what the United States is going to look in 30 years, you know, we need to think about that as well. It's not just about what's going on right now, but what will happen in 30 years if we don't take action now.
So I know that the Latin American Coalition and the Southeast Asian Coalition both are very active locally. I wonder, are you guys making any sort of a push to, say, get in touch with your senators or to get in touch with your representatives to see if you can have a voice as this bill is being, you know, shaped and altered?
Absolutely. We've been really pushing both Senator Hagan and Senator Burr for the past couple of weeks to support this bill, asking the folks on our email list, the folks who come to visit us on Facebook. I mean, we're asking people everywhere to call their senators and let them know that they support immigration reform and that the senators should too. One of the most touching things, a few weeks ago, a bunch of folks from the Latin American Coalition went up to Washington, D.C. Some of the people that went were part of a local community group called Familias Unidas, United Families, that are advocating for other families kind of going through deportation proceedings. There was a family who went and had a meeting with Senator Hagan's representatives and basically told them the story. This little girl, an 8-year-old girl, told Senator Hagan's representatives, that she didn't want her father to leave. You know, this girl's a U.S. citizen and her father's undocumented and currently in deportation proceedings. She didn't want her father to leave. She didn't want him to be separated from her and her brothers and sisters and her mommy. And so we're trying to make sure that the senators not only hear about, you know, the border security and the enforcement and all that other stuff, but also hear about the families that this is affecting, that it's going to affect, that it's going to quite possibly either separate or keep together based on their vote.
And Peter, so how likely do you think it is that this big push will work, that this could become a law?
I'm hopeful that it worked, but I have to say, and I have to admit candidly, that I'm not as optimistic as most people, which provides all the more reason for people interested in this debate and for all of us as Americans to really try and have our voices heard and push for immigration reform. The reason I'm less optimistic is the political dynamics that are occurring right now around the reform process. I'm not so concerned about the Senate. Senators tend to be more nationally oriented. Senators got the memo from the National Party that it's demographic suicide to forget about Latinos, and they have to worry about it because these are national-level elections. Latino swing voters can sway a senatorial election pretty easily. I'm concerned about the House, though, because many in the House are much more concerned about a Tea Party primary challenger from the right than they are about Latino voters, either because they're not concerned about demographics, they don't have Latino voters, or their districts are so incredibly gerrymandered. Fair Vote just released a study that showed there's only 21 effectively competitive House races approaching the next House election,
wow,
which is minuscule because of gerrymandering. So many of these House members are not going to be on board for a positive vote on comprehensive immigration reform because it's going to hurt them and it's going to leave them vulnerable on the right. So for those of us who are interested in immigration reform, we have to put pressure and let people know that they need that, let representatives know that they need to vote the right way on this, and it's in all of our interests, whether we have swing voters, Latinos or not. It's in all of our interests to push for comprehensive immigration reform and to come to an agreement on this. Any scenario that's going to work, in my view, is going to work the following way. If we can generate about 70 votes in the Senate, support in the Senate and the House bill will then collide. It'll force a conference committee to hammer out some of the differences, and I think that's the only way we're going to get a comprehensive immigration reform.
Because I guess that would scale down the number of people potentially in the House that are initially working on the compromise?
Absolutely.
And how likely do you think this bill is to, I mean, again, we're talking about 844 pages. I mean, how likely do we think this is to change some as these conferences are happening, as, you know, more people are getting in touch with legislators? How big do you think the tweaks will be?
I mean, I don't think they're going to be that big, because if you look at the kind of proposals that President Obama announced, they very much parallel what the Gang of Eight deal puts down on paper in terms of the potential for reform. So I don't think we're really that far apart on an agreement. It's just incentivizing House members to vote the right way. This could happen. This could happen if we negotiate in goodwill and if we as citizens put pressure on our representatives to work for reform.
That's all the time we have today. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. Peter Ciavellis, political science professor at Wake Forest University, Armando Belmas, spokesman for the Latin American Coalition, and Elver Barrios, thank you all for being here.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
And I'd also like to thank Charlotte Talks executive producer Wendy Herkey for putting the show together.